what is the most simple explanation for this? Well, the simplest explanation is someone is going to come forward with specific knowledge of Rudy being drunk that night. Either it's video. He said very not only did. See, here's the problem. Not only did Rudy deny being drunk, he said he refused all alcohol. So because Rudy went above and beyond in his denial, if there is any evidence that he had any alcohol that night, he now is a liar. You could say, I was not drunk. I had a drink. I was not drunk. And then if someone comes forward and says, here's a picture of Rudy with a drink, you're not necessarily an obvious liar. Rudy still is a liar, of course, but you're not necessarily an obvious liar. Here, it's a different thing where Rudy said, I refused alcohol the entire evening. Now, as a reminder, we're not making fun of alcoholism if that is something Rudy struggles with. There are widespread reports that during the Trump presidency, the schedulers around Trump started booking Rudy Giuliani for morning TV shows rather than evening, because it turned out that in the evenings he would allegedly show up drunk after having a bunch of drinks at dinner. We also have videos like this one, which, again, I know some of you have seen, but where he genuinely seems completely wasted.
Can you imagine that, Tony Blinken or Miley? How's that guy a general? Jesus. The other day, he said that the Bagram Air Force Base is not strategically important. I wanted to grab his, what do you have, 5 stars, 10 stars, 12 stars? He has so many stars that come into his ears. I wanted to grab his stars, shove it down his throat, and say, it's 400 miles from China,
China, yeah. So anyway, the real issue here is there were people on election night around Trump telling him the truth, which is you lost. But Trump ignored all of them and just accepted what he wanted to hear from an allegedly drunk Rudy Giuliani, which is you probably won, just go out and declare victory. That's the really crazy part of the story. Rudy deleting the tweets just points more in the direction of the testimony being accurate. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192 David P. My story from the bonus show about French toast challah. Challah French toast. Got the Eggman thinking back to his time in prison. As many of you know, the Eggman's been calling into the show for 15 years, and he spent some time in prison for drug related charges. And he often has interesting stories. Here's one of them.
I would kill for some French bread challah right now. Hey, Dave, when I was in prison, because I was a Jew, I made the challah bread for the Jewish guys, right?
Yep.
So I would go in the kitchen, you know, once a week, maybe every couple weeks, we'd freeze a couple. And when I'd make it, we'd add in the yeast, except only the guards could have power over the yeast. So they would dump this yeast in, this big mix. They'd even mix it in a little bit so we couldn't take it out. Of course, I would take it out, and I would trade it to the Native Americans. They would make alcohol with the yeast that I gave them, and then they would trade us cannabis. So the Jews would get high on Shabbat instead of, you know, have good challah. However, with half the yeast, our challah still came out. It was still okay. We did a good job. Your baby and the challah were both items. Shalom, brother.
All right. So the Eggman with an explosive look at the trading that took place when he was in prison. Eggman, we should really have Eggman on. He has the best stories. I know he wants to keep himself private, but I think he could tell us some very interesting stories. We have a great bonus show coming up for you today. Sign up at joinpacman.com to get in.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh, right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM, word to your mother.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3. FM. Now and forever.
WRCT.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I would have laid my body across the road before I would have let the vice president overturn the 2020 election on the basis of that historical precedent.
In its third public hearing, the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection showed how Donald Trump knew his plan to overturn the 2020 election was illegal, but pushed Vice President Mike Pence to do it anyway, with backing from attorney John Eastman. Witnesses testifying on Thursday included the retired conservative judge Michael Luttig. We'll bring you highlights of the hearing, and we'll stay in the Capitol to speak with Poor People's Campaign leaders Liz Theoharis and Bishop William Barber about this Saturday's massive moral march on Washington.
We are not trying to get back to normal. Normal is not what we need. Transformation is what we need. We already know truth and love and justice win. Our job is to run all the way through the finish line.
But first, the UK Home Secretary has approved the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the United States, where he faces up to 175 years in prison if convicted of violating the Espionage Act for publishing classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. We'll get an update from Julian Assange's brother. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. UK Home Secretary Priti Patel has approved the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the United States. Assange faces up to 175 years in prison in the United States if convicted of violating the Espionage Act for publishing classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. WikiLeaks said today Assange would appeal today's ruling. His attorney, Jen Robinson, condemned the U.K. for extraditing Assange to a country which once considered assassinating him. In a statement, WikiLeaks said, quote, "It was in Priti Patel's power to do the right thing. Instead, she will forever be remembered as an accomplice of the United States and its agenda to turn investigative journalism into a criminal enterprise." Jamil Jaffer of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University tweeted, "The Assange indictment is a dagger at the throat of press freedom. The Biden administration should drop the prosecution, as press freedom groups have repeatedly asked it to do," unquote. We'll speak with Julian Assange's brother after headlines. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection has revealed Donald Trump knew his plan to overturn the 2020 election was illegal, but pushed his vice president, Mike Pence, to take part anyway in what the committee has described as an attempted coup. But Pence refused to take part after Trump asked him to unilaterally reject the Electoral College results on January 6. The committee also revealed the architect of Trump's plan, the attorney John Eastman, also knew the plan was illegal but pushed it anyway. Eastman later sought a pardon for himself. Witnesses testifying on Thursday included Michael Luttig, a retired judge and one of the most influential right-wing legal experts in the country. He described Trump as a clear and present danger to American democracy. Judge Luttig warned that Trump and allies will also attempt to overturn the 2024 election if they lose, and this time they may succeed. We'll have more on the House hearing later in the broadcast. The Senate Armed Services Committee has endorsed an $847 billion military budget. That's $45 billion more than requested by President Biden. Democratic Senator Jack Reed, the chair of the committee, said some of the extra money is needed to replenish weapons sent to Ukraine. There is, however, a push in Congress by some progressives to shrink the Pentagon's budget. Earlier this week, Democratic Representatives Barbara Lee and Mark Pocan introduced the People Over Pentagon Act of 2022, which calls for cutting $100 billion from the military budget. In a statement, Congressmember Lee said, quote, "The amount of money the defense industry convinces Congress to spend each year doesn't protect us from real threats like climate change, pandemics, or cyber attacks. It only lines contractors' pockets. Just imagine for once if we led the world in funding peace and not wars," Lee said. Ukraine has moved a step closer to joining the European Union. Earlier today, the European Commission recommended Ukraine, as well as Moldova, be granted candidate status for EU membership. This comes a day after the presidents of France, Germany, Italy, and Romania traveled to Ukraine to meet with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. Earlier today, French President Emmanuel Macron said he would consider traveling to Moscow to negotiate with Russia's President Vladimir Putin if certain conditions were met. Macron last met with Putin 2 weeks before the invasion. The World Trade Organization's agreed to temporarily waive some intellectual property rights on COVID vaccines, but no agreement was reached on lifting patent monopolies on COVID treatments and tests. Hundreds of international groups, including Oxfam and Amnesty International, criticized the final deal, saying it'll make it harder for developing countries to respond to the pandemic. This is Nick Dearden, director of Global Justice Now.
What we've got from the World Trade Organization this morning is a poor excuse for a waiver. It is not what we've been calling for the last 18 months. And the fault for that lies with European governments, particularly Britain, Switzerland, and Germany. So we're not happy about that. But there's one thing we can bank from this. It really is proof that the big pharma monopoly system did not help deal with the COVID-19 pandemic and did not help deal with it equitably. Most importantly, it drove vaccine inequality.
At least 2,000 cows have died in recent days in Kansas due to excessive heat and humidity. Much of the United States has been facing a brutal heat wave this week, as more than 1,800 temperature records have been shattered from California to Michigan. More than 100 million people have been advised to stay indoors due to the excessive heat. Europe and much of South Asia are also facing record heat waves this week. UCLA climate scientist Daniel Swain said more extreme heat events will keep occurring if global emissions are not slashed.
Obviously, in the long run, the only solution is to bring carbon emissions close to zero and eventually halt global warming and thereby halt the increase in extreme heat events.
President Biden has approved a major disaster declaration for Montana after massive floods forced the closing of Yellowstone National Park. Heavy rainstorms and melting snowcaps led the Yellowstone River to swell by more than 2 feet over its previous high. The raging waters swept away homes, bridges, and roads. New research shows temperatures in parts of the Arctic are warming at a rate 7 times faster than the global average. This, according to the journal Scientific Reports, parts of the Arctic are nearly 5 degrees warmer than a decade ago. The warming is expected to lead to more extreme weather in North America, Europe, and Asia. In other climate news, a group of environmental organizations have sued the Biden administration over the issuing of more than 3,500 permits to drill for oil and gas on public lands in New Mexico and Wyoming. The lawsuit says the drilling could result in 600 million metric tons of greenhouse gas emissions. Jeremy Nichols of the group Wild Earth Guardian said, quote, "The Biden administration's literally drilling away the climate." The nation's largest baby formula manufacturer, Abbott Nutrition, has been forced to pause operations at its plant in Sturgis, Michigan, due to massive flooding and after heavy rains overwhelmed the city's drainage system. The plant is expected to stay closed for a few weeks. The plant had just recently reopened after being ordered closed in February due to contamination. The plant's closure led to a nationwide shortage of baby formula, which still exists in parts of the United States today. Israeli forces have shot dead 3 Palestinians and injured 10 others during a raid in the city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. Al Jazeera reports 30 Israeli military vehicles took part in the operation last month. Al Jazeera reporter Shireen Abu Akla was shot dead while covering another Israeli raid in Jenin. Earlier this week, The Washington Post became the latest news outlet to conclude she was shot by Israeli forces despite Israel's initial denial. Meanwhile, an Israeli politician has sparked outcry after publicly saying he wishes there was a way to get rid of all Palestinians. Israel's deputy religious affairs minister, Matan Kahana, said in a televised speech, quote, "If there was a button I could press that would take all the Arabs and put them on a train to Switzerland, I would." And in news from Egypt, the imprisoned Egyptian activist Ala Abdel Fattah is approaching his 11th week on hunger strike to protest the harsh conditions he's held under at Cairo's Toura prison. Earlier this week, one of Ala's sisters, Sana Saif, described her brother's dire situation.
My brother is slowly dying in his prison cell, but he wants to live. He misses life. He misses his job. He misses his son and us. On Sunday, my sister visited him in prison, Mona. When she saw him, she was shocked. She hasn't been able to eat since. The effect was such that she decided to start a hunger strike herself in solidarity. She told me, "I have to use my body as a portal to show people what's happening to Ali."
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. UK Home Secretary Priti Patel has approved the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the United States. Assange faces up to 175 years in prison here in the U.S. if convicted of violating the Espionage Act for publishing classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. WikiLeaks has announced Assange will appeal today's ruling. In a statement, WikiLeaks said, quote, "Julian did nothing wrong. He's committed no crime and is not a criminal. He's a journalist and a publisher, and he's being punished for doing his job," unquote. Just before we went to air today, Assange's wife, Stella Morris, spoke at a news conference addressing today's ruling.
The extradition order rests on a decision to reverse the initial outcome, a decision by the High Court to accept assurances that are severely flawed, that the Amnesty International called that decision a travesty. That is what this extradition order is resting on. We're going to raise points that have come up since the original extradition hearing back in 2020. And crucially, one of the most important developments is the revelation that the CIA plotted to assassinate Julian while he was in the Ecuadorian embassy and kidnap him and rendition him and was exploring poisoning him. This is known to the Home Secretary, but she signed it off anyway, but we will be raising it on appeal.
That's Julian Assange's wife and attorney, Stella Morris. We are now going here in New York City to Gabriel Shipton, filmmaker, Julian Assange's brother. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Gabriel. Can you respond first to the Home Secretary's ruling?
Well, this is, this ruling just says, the UK government agrees that a journalist, a publisher can be taken from the UK, can be extradited from the UK solely for doing their job. So this is a huge, hugely dangerous precedent that's been set in the UK for journalists and publishers there. So this is just goes to show that this is a once-in-a-lifetime fight for press freedom. And it is inching closer, this is coming to the US. The UK government wants Julian extradited. The judiciary has ruled against Julian in favour of the US DOJ to extradite Julian. So I think people can no longer rely on the UK government or the UK judiciary to protect journalism, that people in the USA need to stand up for press freedoms and fight this case.
A group of more than 300 doctors from around the world are calling on Patel to block the extradition. Of course, she chose not to, saying that he suffered a mini stroke last October. His overall health is continuing to deteriorate. They write, the extradition of a person with such compromised health, moreover, is medically and ethically unacceptable. Can you talk about his condition right now, and will you appeal?
So, yes, that's right. Julian had a mini stroke at the end of October. He has been detained in the UK one way or another for the last 12 years. If you can imagine what that is like, you know, Julian hasn't seen a blade of grass in 12 years. He has been in a maximum security prison for the last 3 years. There's this endless legal snakes and ladders that he has been put through. And it is really, you know, he's a gentle genius, a publisher. He's not a violent criminal. He is not convicted of any crime. He's an innocent man who's been held in prison solid at the request of the US DOJ. And this is really wearing him down. He's been worn down over these 12 years. The UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Niels Melzer, found that he was suffering the effects of psychological torture. So, you know, it's so sad to see Julian, the Julian that I know from years ago, and the Julian that I've seen in the prison.
And the significance of what it was that he released back in 2010 and has continued to release information over the years, even when he was, what, in political exile in the Ecuadorian consulate in London.
Yes, that's right. And none of so he's published evidence of war crimes, torture in Guantanamo Bay, government corruption, you know, even the collateral murder video that's world famous. None of these, you know, and it's the publisher that has been punished in this situation. It's none of the criminals, none of the people who have committed these crimes that there is much evidence for. It is the publisher in this situation that is receiving the punishment. The New York Times, Der Spiegel, Washington Post, The Guardian, they all published similar information, and none of them are facing the punishment that Julian is. We are going to fight this ruling by Priti Patel. We have an opportunity to appeal, apply to appeal to the High Court in the UK and then to the European Court of Human Rights. So we're going to fight this, but with this ruling, it's saying the UK government, they want to move this forward. They want to extradite Julian to the USA.
Finally, Gabriel, the issue of the United States assuring Britain, if it extradites Julian, he would be able to serve any sentence imposed on him by a U.S. court in Australia. What does this mean, especially given the new administration in Australia, the new prime minister?
Well, that's a treaty obligation that's available to everyone who's convicted in the USA. It sort of means nothing because, you know, by the time Julian gets extradited to the USA, court proceedings, you know, will be at least 2 years. If he appeals to the Supreme Court, we're looking at an 8 to 10 year process. So, you know, if you add that on to the 12 years he's already been detained, that's 20 years that Julian has had no freedom whatsoever, 3 of those years in a maximum security prison. So,
but it is interesting the new Australian Prime Minister has said in the past, Albanese. Can you tell us?
Yes. So Anthony Albanese has, in opposition, he said enough is enough in regard to Julian being kept in prison. He said, I don't see what purpose is served by keeping Julian in prison. That was before the election. Asked after he was elected as Prime Minister if he stood by those statements, and he said foreign policy, not all foreign policy is conducted with a bullhorn. So that is a very significant departure from previous government statements where they said this is a matter for the UK courts. You know, Julian's receiving consular assistance now. Anthony Albanese has signalled that this is a foreign policy issue, and by saying that it's not foreign policy is not conducted with the bullhorn, it suggests that there are some negotiations happening behind closed doors. So, you know, Julian is very popular in Australia. There was a poll in December, and 70%. It was in a national newspaper. 71% of those polled agreed with the statement that Julian should be brought home. So the new Prime Minister has to represent the will of the people in Australia. And overwhelmingly, people in Australia want this to come to a close.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Gabriel Shipton, filmmaker and Julian Assange's brother. Next up, we're going to the highlights from Thursday's hearing on the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. Stay with us. Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the third public hearing of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. On Thursday, committee members revealed in detail how Donald Trump knew his plan to overturn the 2020 election was illegal, but pushed his vice president, Mike Pence, to take part in what the committees described as an attempted coup. But Pence refused to take part after Trump asked him to unilaterally reject the Electoral College results on January 6th. The committee also revealed the architect of Trump's plan, attorney John Eastman, also knew the plan was illegal but pushed it anyway and later sought a pardon for himself. Witnesses testifying live on Thursday included Michael Luttig, a retired judge, one of the most influential right-wing legal experts.
In short, if I had been advising the Vice President of the United States on January 6th, and even if then Vice President Jefferson and even then Vice President John Adams and even then Vice President Richard Nixon had done exactly what the President of the United States wanted his Vice President to do, I would have laid my body across the road before I would have let the Vice President overturn the 2020 election on the basis of that historical precedent.
Retired Judge Luttig described Trump as a clear and present danger to American democracy. He warned Trump and allies will also attempt to overturn the 2024 election if they lose, saying this time they may succeed. We're going to go now back to the beginning, to the opening statements at the hearing by Pete Aguilar, Democrat of California. But first, the vice chair of the committee, Liz Cheney, the Republican of Wyoming.
Let me take just a few minutes today to put the topic of our hearing in broader context. In our last hearing, we heard unequivocal testimony that President Trump was told his election fraud allegations were complete nonsense. We heard this from members of the Trump campaign. We heard this from President Trump's campaign lawyers. We heard this from President Trump's former Attorney General, Bill Barr. We heard this from President Trump's former acting Attorney General, Jeff Rosen. And we heard this from President Trump's former acting Deputy Attorney General, Richard Donahue. We heard from members of President Trump's White House staff as well. Today, we're focusing on President Trump's relentless effort to pressure Mike Pence to refuse to count electoral votes on January 6th. Here again is how the former vice president phrased it in a speech before the Federalist Society, a group of conservative lawyers.
This week, that President Trump said I had the right to overturn the election. President Trump is wrong. I had no right to overturn the election. The presidency belongs to the American people and the American people alone. And frankly, there is no idea more un-American than the notion that any one person could choose the American president.
What the president wanted the vice president to do was not just wrong. It was illegal and unconstitutional. We will hear many details in today's hearing, but please consider these two points. First, President Trump was told repeatedly that Mike Pence lacked the constitutional and legal authority to do what President Trump was demanding he do. This is testimony from Mark Short, the vice president's chief of staff, who served in the Trump administration in multiple positions over 4 years.
But just to pick up on that, Mr. Short, was it your impression that the vice president had directly conveyed his position on these issues to the president, not just to the world through a Dear Colleague letter, but directly to President Trump?
Many times.
And he'd been consistent in conveying his position to the president?
Very consistent.
Okay.
But President Trump plotted with a lawyer named John Eastman to pressure Pence to do so anyway. As the federal court has explained, quote, based on the evidence, the court finds that it is more likely than not that President Trump and Dr. Eastman dishonestly conspired to obstruct the joint session of Congress on January 6, 2021. What exactly did President Trump know? When exactly did President Trump know that it would be illegal for Mike Pence to refuse to count electoral votes? Here is one sample of testimony given by one of the witnesses before us today, the Vice President's General Counsel.
Did John Eastman ever admit, or as you know, in front of the President, that his proposal would violate the Electoral Count Act?
I believe he did on the 4th.
That was January 4th, 2 days before the attack on Congress. A second point, please listen to testimony today about all of the ways that President Trump attempted to pressure Vice President Pence, including Donald Trump's tweet at 2:24 p.m. condemning Vice President Mike Pence when President Trump already knew a violent riot was underway at the Capitol. In future hearings, you will hear from witnesses who were present inside the White House, who were present inside the West Wing, on that day. But today we focus on the earnest efforts of Mike Pence, who was determined to abide by his oath of office. As Vice President Pence prepared a statement on January 5th and 6th, explaining that he could not illegally refuse to count electoral votes, he said this to his staff.
I mean, the Vice President had said, this may be the most important thing I ever say. The statement. And he really wanted to make sure that it was just so.
You will hear today that President Trump's White House counsel believed that the Vice President did exactly the right thing on January 6th, as did others in the White House, as did Fox News host Sean Hannity. Vice President Pence understood that his oath of office was more important than his loyalty to Donald Trump. He did his duty. President Trump unequivocally did not. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
Without objection, I recognize the gentleman from California, Mr. Aguilar, for an opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Today, we intend to show the American people that January 6th was not an isolated incident. In the weeks culminating before, it was a legal scheme and deception. We've already learned that President Trump knew he lost the 2020 election. Shortly after, he began to look for a way to circumvent our country's most fundamental civic tradition, the peaceful transfer of power. The president latched on to a dangerous theory and would not let go because he was convinced it would keep him in office. We witnessed firsthand what happened when the president of the United States weaponized this theory. The Capitol was overrun, police officers lost their lives, and the vice president was taken to a secure location because his safety was in jeopardy. Let's take a look at the effect of Donald Trump's words and actions. I want to warn our audience that the video contains explicit content.
Mike Pence is going to have to come through for us, and if he doesn't, that will be a sad day for our country. And Mike Pence, I hope you're going to stand up for the good of our Constitution and for the good of our country. And if you're not, I'm going to be very disappointed in you, I will tell you right now.
I'm telling you what, I'm hearing the Pence. I hear the Pence just caved.
No.
Is that true?
I didn't
I'm hearing reports that Pence caved.
No.
I'm telling you, if Pence caved, we're going to drag motherfuckers through the streets. You politicians are going to get drugged through the streets.
Yes.
I guess the hope is that there's such a show of force here that Pence will decide to just do the right thing, according to Trump.
How did we get to this point? How did we get to the point where President Trump's most radical supporters led a violent attack on the Capitol and threatened to hang President Trump's own vice president? You'll hear from witnesses that Donald Trump pressured Mike Pence to adopt a legally and morally bankrupt idea that the vice president could choose who the next president can be. You'll hear about how the vice president, the White House counsel, and others told Donald Trump that the vice president had no such authority. But President Trump would not listen. You'll hear how Vice President Pence withstood an onslaught of pressure from President Trump, both publicly and privately, a pressure campaign that built to a fever pitch with a heated phone call on January 6th. You'll also hear that the president knew there was a violent mob at the Capitol when he tweeted at 2:24 p.m., that the vice president did not have the, quote, courage to do what needed to be done. Let me be clear. Vice President Pence did the right thing that day. He stayed true to his oath to protect and defend the Constitution.
That was January 6th committee member Pete Aguilar's opening statement at Thursday's public hearing following Liz Cheney and the chair of the House of the January 6th Select Committee, Benny Thompson, Mississippi Democrat. Congressmember Aguilar went on to question Greg Jacob, the top White House lawyer for former Vice President Mike Pence. This was live questioning during the hearing. This is Congressman Aguilar.
Testimony in our investigation has made clear what the target of the rioters' ire was, Vice President Mike Pence. The rioters breached the Capitol at 2:13 p.m. Now let's take a look at what was going on at the White House at this time. We received testimony that the president's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, was notified of the violence at the Capitol by 2 p.m. and likely earlier. The testimony further establishes that Mr. Meadows quickly informed the president and that he did so before the president issued his 2:24 p.m. tweet criticizing Vice President Pence for not having, quote, courage to do what needed to be done. And here is what the rioters thought.
nothing but a traitor, and he deserves to burn with the rest of them.
So it's all escalated after Pence. What happened to Pence? Pence didn't do what we wanted.
Pence voted against Trump.
Okay, and that's when all this started?
Yep, that's when we marched on the Capitol. We've been shot at with rubber bullets, tear gas.
Betrayed us, which apparently everybody knew he was going to, and the president mentioned it like 5 times when he talked. You can go back and watch the president's video.
This is our capital. Let's be respectful to him. There's 4 million people coming in, so there's a lot of control. We love you guys. We love the cops.
It's only a matter of time. Justice is coming.
Although the president's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, has refused to testify before this committee, Mr. Meadows' aide, Ben Williamson, and White House Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Matthews testified that Mr. Meadows went to the dining room near the Oval Office to tell the president about the violence at the Capitol before the president's 2:24 p.m. tweet. Our investigation found that immediately after the president's 2:24 p.m. tweet, the crowds both outside the Capitol and inside the Capitol surged. The crowds inside the Capitol were able to overwhelm the law enforcement presence, and the Vice President was quickly evacuated from his ceremonial Senate office to a secure location within the Capitol complex.
By 2:24 p.m., the Secret Service had moved Vice President Pence from the Senate chamber to his office across the hall.
The noise from the rioters became audible, at which point we recognized that maybe they had gotten into the building.
Then President Trump tweeted, "Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution, giving states a chance to certify a corrected set of facts, not the fraudulent or inaccurate ones which they were asked to previously certify. USA demands the truth."
It was clear that it was escalating and escalating quickly. So then when that tweet, the Mike Pence tweet, was sent out, I remember us saying that that was the last thing that needed to be tweeted at that moment. The situation was already bad. And so it felt like he was pouring gasoline on the fire by tweeting that.
30 seconds later, rioters already inside the Capitol opened the East Rotunda door just down the hall. And just 30 seconds after that, rioters breached the crypt, one floor below the Vice President.
The Secret Service couldn't control the situation and do their job of keeping him safe.
At 2:26 p.m., Secret Service rushed Vice President Pence down the stairs.
I think they had been trying to figure out whether they had a clear route to get us to wherever it was that they wanted to move us to.
We moved pretty quickly down the stairs and through various hallways and tunnels to the secure location. Upon arriving there, there was further discussion as to whether or not we were going to leave the Capitol complex or stay where we were.
Vice President Pence and his team ultimately were led to a secure location where they stayed for the next 4.5 hours. Barely missing rioters a few feet away. Approximately 40 feet. That's all there was. 40 feet between the Vice President and the mob. Mr. Jacob, you were there, seeing that for the first time. Does it surprise you to see how close the mob was to the evacuation route that you took? The 40 feet is the distance from me to you, roughly.
I could hear the din of the rioters in the building while we moved, but I don't think I was aware that they were as close as that.
Make no mistake about the fact that the vice president's life was in danger. A recent court filing by the Department of Justice explains that a confidential informant from the Proud Boys told the FBI that the Proud Boys would have killed Mike Pence if given a chance. This witness, whom the FBI affidavit refers to as W1, stated that other members of the group talked about things they did that day, and they said that anyone they got their hands on, they would have killed, including Nancy Pelosi. W1 further stated that members of the Proud Boys said that they would have killed Mike Pence if given a chance.
That's Democratic Congressmember Pete Aguilar. Also during Thursday's hearing, Trump White House lawyer Eric Hirschman described in recorded testimony his call with John Eastman, the lawyer advising former President Trump on the plan to overturn the 2020 election. The call took place on January 7th, the day after the deadly insurrection.
The day after, Eastman, I don't remember why he called me, he texted me or called me, wanted to talk with me, and he said he couldn't reach others. And he started to ask me about something dealing with Georgia and preserving something potentially for appeal. And I said to him, are you out of your effing mind? Right? I said, I only want to hear two words coming out of your mouth from now on. Orderly transition. And he screamed and said, I don't want to hear any other effing words coming out of your mouth, no matter what, other than orderly transition. Repeat those words to me. And I screamed and said, eventually he said, orderly transition. I said, good, John. Now I'm going to give you the best free legal advice you're ever getting in your life. Get a great effing criminal defense lawyer. You're going to need it. And then I hung up on him.
This is Congressman Aguilar.
In fact, just a few days later, Dr. Eastman emailed Rudy Giuliani and requested that he be included on a list of potential recipients of a presidential pardon. Dr. Eastman's email stated, quote, I've decided that I should be on the pardon list, if that is still in the works. Dr. Eastman did not receive his presidential pardon. So let's see what Dr. Eastman did as a result when he was deposed by this committee.
I assert my Fifth Amendment right against being compelled to be a witness against myself.
Did the Trump legal team ask you to prepare a memorandum regarding the vice president's role in the counting of electoral votes at the joint session of Congress on January 6, 2022? Yeah. Dr. Eastman, did you advise the president of the United States that the vice president could reject electors from seven states and declare that the president had been reelected? Yeah. Dr. Eastman, the first sentence of the memo starts off by saying, seven states have transmitted dual slates of electors to the president of the Senate. Is that statement in this memo true?
Yes.
Did President Trump authorize you to discuss publicly your January 4th, 2021 conversation with him?
Yes.
So is it your position that you can discuss in the media direct conversations you had with the President of the United States, but you will not discuss those same conversations with this committee?
Fifth.
Dr. Eastman pled the fifth 100 times.
That's highlights from the third public hearing of the U.S. House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. The fourth hearing is set for Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern. We'll be live streaming that at democracynow.org. Coming up next, a major march on Washington this weekend, the Poor People's March. We'll be speaking with the Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris and Bishop William Barber. Stay with us.
The verbal door knocker will murder all my foe and kill him. But learning all and so I'm growing while I'm learning with him. Inferno Alex flow, we turning out the globe about to blow. Now get up out of your seat, head on out the zones that I patrol. I rock and roll, I tear you out the soul like drugs and alcohol. I knock your whole kabak and
out, the doubt will flow. I'm not the bro you wanna knock, cause on the rail I got the glow. Cosmic poses, I suppose it's how I'm supposed to be and got to go. How'd you know? Intuition, I was on the old space surface. Figure out your purpose, that's impossible. Logic won't disturb the thought or focus. What it's not is all about to grow, about the kind of homeless only God can know. I rock it for the chocolate, for the aqua, for the thoughtless. In your home or at your office, I'm your early morning coffee sip. Who got the ball? We roll with Navajos with double barrels. Amazing major danger, hazy waves, my blazing arrow.
Blazing Arrow by Blacklicious. This is Democracy Now! This weekend marks the one-year anniversary of the passing of rapper Gift of Gab. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the United States experiences its worst inflation in decades, with skyrocketing food, gas, and energy prices, we end today's show in Washington, D.C., where the Poor People's Campaign has organized a massive moral march on Washington Saturday. The demonstrations being led by low-income people and workers demanding access to stable housing, health care, living wages, gun control, and reproductive and voting rights. For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Bishop Dr. William Barber II, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, president of Repairers of the Breach. We also hope to speak with Dr. Liz Theo Harris, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. Bishop Barber, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you can talk about what you're doing in Washington, as inside the Capitol there is this epic, historic hearing around the previous president's attempted coup, the man who would not let go of power but was forced to in the end. I'm wondering if you could contrast what we're seeing exposed there with what you're doing this weekend.
Well, thank you, Amy. We are not the insurrection. We are the resurrection. And the resurrection of thousands of every race and creed and color and kind and geography who are coming nonviolently to Washington, D.C. from all across this great land to say that the 140 million poor and low wealth people in this country, 43% of this nation, 52% of the children, 60% of black people, 30% of white people, 68% of Latinos, and so forth and so on. 87 million people who are uninsured or underinsured, 32 million people that get up every morning and work jobs that do not pay a living wage, less than $15 an hour. We won't be silent or unseen anymore. The time has come for us to have a third Reconstruction. We had one in the 1800s, one in the 1960s. We need one now. That's about policy, reconstructing our moral framework, political framework in this country. Because to have that this level of poverty that's untalked about too often and unseen and unheard is actually morally indefensible, constitutionally inconsistent, politically insensitive, and economically insane. So people are coming. But poor people are coming to say, not only do we need a moral reset, and low-wage workers are saying it, we represent 32% of the electorate, now poor people do, and 45% of the electorate in battleground states. And it's time for that power to be organized, mobilized, and felt in every election throughout this country. Now, when we look at what you see in these hearings, we have to ask the question, I think, why were Trumpism or Trump and his team fighting to hold on to power? Why wouldn't McConnell and them impeach him when they had a chance? I believe, Amy, and we believe, this isn't just about personality, but policy. We're witnessing a crisis of democracy because some of the people who didn't go along with Trump in this and didn't go along with Eastman's scheme still took the time to see if it was right, if there was a way they could do it. They still voted 99% of the time for Trump's policies of extremism. And they still believe in a political policy coup d'etat to suppress the vote, to rob the government of its resources by giving tax cuts to the wealthiest and to the greediest and the corporate interests that disempowers the government from doing the things it needs to do for the least and the left out and the workers and women. They're still the group that wants to take, to have a political coup d'etat and take women's rights to their own body. They're still the group that wants to block living wages, block health care, block addressing climate change, block police violence. And all of these policies produce a policy murder. And we found out just this week that the denial of universal health care during COVID, for instance, has cost 330,000 lives. We found out because of Trump and his allies' policies in the beginning of COVID, poor people died at a rate of 2 to 5 times higher than anyone else in this country. So we are the contrast. What you saw January 6th was the insurrection. What you see on Saturday is a resurrection. It's a resurrection of people coming together, the mass poor people's low-wage workers assembly and moral march to the polls. And we are calling on people to still join us at 3rd in Pennsylvania at 9:30 a.m. on Saturday morning.
Liz Theo Harris is also with us, the Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, who is co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign and president, also executive director of the Kairos Center at Union Theological Seminary. Liz, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you could talk about the significance of this march, and this coming at a time where a Yale study just came out saying that something like 338,000 people who died of COVID-19 during the pandemic in the United States, a third of the people died unnecessarily, could have been saved if the U.S. had Medicare for all. Can you talk about how health care is a basic right as one of the tenets of what people are calling for in Washington?
Well, thanks so much, Amy, and it is great to be back. And as Bishop Barber said, and as you just referenced, this study came out this week that says that, yeah, a third of the people who did not have health care would not have died from this pandemic. What we in the Poor People's Campaign have been putting out, and we did a study with Jeffrey Sachs and with folks over at Columbia University that showed that between 2 and 5 times the number of poor people from poor communities died from the pandemic than richer communities and richer people. And again, this is because of these underlying issues of health inequality, of poverty, of low wages. And so indeed, when we gather on Pennsylvania Avenue on Saturday and we hear the voices, the stories, but also the solutions coming out of poor and low-income people's experience and lives, we will surely hear about the need for health care. As Bishop Barber has said, we need health care to be connected to people's bodies, not to their jobs. And how is it in this rich nation that spends more money on health care than any other nation with a comparable economy still has the kind of poor health outcomes, still has 87 million people who before the pandemic were uninsured or underinsured, and even some who have, you know, tens of thousands who have lost their health care coverage in the worst public health crisis in generations. And again, this just does not have to be. It actually, we could spend less on health care and lead healthier lives, and everyone could have universal coverage. We need to expand Medicaid, but we also need to, you know, implement a single-payer universal health care system. And again, this will lift society from the bottom. And so this, and then the cry and demand for living wage jobs, for adequate housing, for immigration reform, for protecting this democracy, they're all connected. And we see the interconnections and intersections of the denial of health care, the destruction of our environment, the militarization of our communities, and the problems of poverty and low wages that are infecting almost half of the population, and therefore, you know, bringing this impoverished democracy to a real crisis.
Liz Theo Harris, you've also said that declaring war is a declaration of war on the poor. Explain.
So So, you know, that actually comes from Dr. King and from many that have come before. But Dr. King, you know, when he comes out against the Vietnam War all those years ago, says that war in all its form is a war on the poor, and it's cruel manipulation of the poor. And we're seeing this today. I mean, we don't have a draft in this country, but we have a poverty draft. And 22 veterans commit suicide every day in this country because of the moral costs of war. And if we look at, you know, our military budget, 53 cents of every discretionary dollar goes to the military. We can't even spend 15 cents on health care and living wage jobs and investments in our children and in anti-poverty programs combined. You know, this disproportionately impacts poor people, and that's poor people in the United States, and that's poor people across the world. As Dr. King said, you know, you have poor people come together from this rich nation to go and kill poor people across the world. And we're seeing this, across the world, you know, in this moment as well.
Bishop Barber, this is Pride Month, and there have been serious attacks or attempted attacks from Coeur d'Alene to the Bay Area. You had Patriot Front in Coeur d'Alene, a small army stop police before they attacked a Pride march. Can you talk about the far right and the white supremacists using Christianity to justify what they're doing?
Well, I don't call them right. I never use the term far right and far left. I think those terms are problematic. And one of the things the Poor People's Campaign is saying is we need to have a moral conversation about right versus wrong, constitutional versus unconstitutional. And that's part of our problem. The reality is that that's heresy. Anytime you use religion to justify violence against gay people, against women, against the poor, against any segment of the community, when you use it to suppress the vote, when you use religion to try to block living wages and health care, it is exactly wrong. One of the reasons it's wrong from a moral and a religious standpoint is because those become the policies of death. You know, every piece of regressive policy costs lives. When you deny health care, it costs lives. When you attack LGBT communities, you cost lives. When you allow guns to flourish in the society, people to walk around with AK-47s, you cost lives. When you block living wages and people moving up out of poverty, we knew that even before COVID hit, poor people were dying at a rate of 700 people a day, nearly 30 people an hour per day, 250,000 a year from the effects of poverty. That is contrary to the biblical call to life. It is contrary to the call of the ancient prophets that says, woe unto those who legislate evil and rob the poor of their rights and make women and children their prey, P-R-E-Y. It's contrary to the call of Jesus that we're supposed to be about life and good news to the poor. And it's contrary to the Declaration of Independence that we are supposed to be about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and contrary to the Constitution, promised to establish justice and equal protection under the law. We are a movement of life. What we're saying is, and on Saturday, we're having black people, white people, brown people, Asian people, Native people, gay people, straight people, Republicans, Democrats, veterans, non-veterans. These are the voices you will hear, poor and impacted people on the stage. It's not a march and a rally and an assembly, really.
We have 10 seconds.
For people to come and talk for people. People will talk for themselves. We are the resurrection and not the insurrection.
Well, we want to thank you both so much for being with us. Bishop Dr. William Barber and Dr. Liz Theo Harris, co-chairs of the Poor People's Campaign, holding the Mass Poor People's Assembly and Moral March on Washington on Saturday. Oh, and Liz, I also want to congratulate your sister, Jean Theo Harris. The film, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, based on Jean's best-selling book by the same title, just premiered last night at the Tribeca Film Festival, directed by our former Democracy Now! Producer, Yoruba Richin, as well as Johanna Hamilton. It is fantastic, not to be missed by anyone. It was at the Tribeca Film Festival. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warmanoff, Camille Baker, Tarina Ndura, Sam Alkoff, Tamer Yastudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Conlon. On Monday, Juneteenth special. Don't miss it on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
You're in Pinckney Hall on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. I don't think I oiled up the machinery appropriately. Hang in there.
Old pirates, yes, they rabbi. Sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind. Oh, have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop at the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Yes, some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs. All I ever have, redemption songs. These songs of freedom, songs of freedom.
Good morning. Kenny Joe here. WRCT Pittsburgh, you're in Pinckney Hall. For the next 56 minutes, I'll be playing for you the best in recorded music. No live music today. there's a lot going on right now. We have a brand new holiday, and we have a tradition here at Pinckney Hall of playing music appropriate for the holiday. But with a brand new holiday, that's sometimes it's hard for me to work out. Sometimes there are many angles to it. It's Caribbean Heritage Month, and we have the Poor People's March tomorrow. We'll try to make a nod to all those things during the show today, in addition to presenting you with some new music, which probably doesn't fit into any of those three categories. But before we do any of that, let me tell you about...